from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
5 years ago, Pope Benedict XVI shocked the entire world with his announcement that he was resigning the papacy, citing concerns about his health and energies to continue as shepherd of the Church's more than 1 billion Catholics. Pope Benedict declared that he was stepping down and leaving to his successor the enormous task of reform and guiding the faithful in a difficult and tumultuous era. This week on Register Radio, we look back on the resignation and explore what it has meant for the Church. We are joined by regular Register contributor Father Raymond D'Souza and Register Vatican correspondent Edward Penton. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio. And I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, who is in studio. Welcome, Matthew.
It's always a treat to be down here to EWTN, and especially to be in studio with you and to have live guests as well.
That's right. We are also joined by Father Raymond D'Souza. It's great to have you here.
Yes, Jeanette. First time in Irondale, actually, at the EWTN headquarters. And so it's nice to see everybody's face and to do it the old-fashioned way, face-to-face. So.
Absolutely. And you have been writing for the Register for some 20 years now.
20 years last spring, 2017, was my first article for the Register was about the World Eucharistic Congress in Wrocław, Poland, 1997. So almost 21 years this year. So
absolutely, and you had a wonderful remembrance of those 20 years written for our 90th anniversary in November.
That's right. I didn't know it was the coincidence of the 20 years and 90 years. And some of the, in show business, they call it getting your big break, which in journalism, I guess you could say that too, but writers don't usually talk about getting a break, but for me, it was actually the death of Mother Teresa, which was the occasion in which I demonstrated that the most important thing in journalism, in writing, is not to write well or even to have something to say, which are important, but not the most important. The most important thing is to write fast. So,
well, thankfully, you do all three things quite well.
So, and that's when I discovered I could write fast, and the Register did, and so 20 years went by.
If you had to think of one, what would be your all-time favorite piece that you've written for the Register?
My favorite piece for the Register actually is not a very important one. It was just before the Great Jubilee opened, which was Christmas Eve 1999. And we had to write, and we'd written so many things about the Jubilee coming. There's nothing left to say. It hadn't even started yet. And at the beginning of December of that year, I was in Rome. There was one of those very bright moons, very low in the sky. It's a special full moon. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this commentary on the moon and how even the celestial orbs were preparing for the Jubilee. And the editor at the time, Tom Hoop, said, "This is ridiculous. You can't write something about the moon." And I said, that's what makes me different, is that I'm going to fit something in about the
moon.
Well,
that's a perfectly good allegory for the church fathers.
It's just the one that's most memorable because it was trying to do something different. But I was lucky to be there for many great occasions. I was in Fatima in 2000 when the Pope went to beatify the two shepherd children. And one of the great things about that visit, it's remembered when he revealed the third secret, which obviously was the most mm-hmm. newsworthy thing. But the night before when he arrived, he placed this ring as a gift to Our Lady of Fatima, the statue. It was a ring given him by Cardinal Wyszynski when he got elected Pope. And Wyszynski had told him, if you're elected Pope, this was the great primate of Poland, your mission will be to lead the Church to the third millennium. And he gave him this ring, which John Paul didn't actually wear.
Yeah.
But he went there at the third millennium. He'd completed the mission. He could have been killed in 1981. Mm-hmm. And so that was the idea that he'd come. He'd completed this mission that had been foretold to him by his great mentor. So there are moments like that. There are many moments like that.
Interesting. You're talking about completing a mission. And, mm-hmm. of course, we're talking about 5 years ago, Pope Benedict the 16th. Abdicates the papacy. He resigns. You wrote a piece that we published at the Register last weekend, Benedict XVI's abdication 5 years later. Where were you, first of all, when he resigned?
I was in Jerusalem on a board. Part of my work in Canada, I do some work with organized Jewish groups, and there was a board meeting. We were there outside the Knesset, the parliament, all Jews except for me, and they said, you know, someone said on his phone, he said, the Pope has resigned. And of course, they turned to me. I'm the only Catholic there, let alone Catholic priest. And I said, well, no, this must be some mistake. That doesn't happen. And then it was actually confirmed later on. And it was a very odd environment because they saw I was quite shaken by it, as mm-hmm. was most people around the world. And they were trying to be consoling, but you know, they didn't feel it the same way that I did. They did realize it was unusual. Everybody knew that. So it was an odd environment. You know, I wasn't at my chaplaincy with my students or in my parish with my parishioners, which would have been a more, if you want to say, probably proper environment mm-hmm, to right. hear it in. So it was an odd day, and it was an earthquake really then, and it still remains so 5 years from now.
And of course, your column, I think readers were interested, maybe a little bit shocked by what you were saying, even in this remembrance of that right. that time. How has your perspective changed since that very first moment when you were taking this in?
Well, the first thing I thought at the time then was this has never been done before. And then the column explains why it actually had never been done before. There are some other resignations in history, but there's never been one like this. And I explained that fact. I knew that even then. So I thought, well, how could something that never been done before be appropriate now, even though there's no great crisis mm-hmm. upon us? But I had great trust and affection and admiration for Benedict then, as I do now. And so, like many others, I said, well, there must be a good reason for it, or there's a lesson to be learned, or it's for the good of the church. So that's what I wrote at the time, even though I found it destabilizing. But I thought, okay. What's changed in 5 years is that Pope Benedict himself has spoken about it. It's, you know, in bits and pieces mm-hmm. with allusions, but then directly in the interview book, The Last Testament, about a year and a half ago, he was asked questions about it, and he gave explanations. And excuse me, what I wrote in this anniversary commentary was that the explanations he gave are not really convincing. Now, there may be other reasons he did it. And when I say not convincing, I mean to me. I mean, other people may right. be convinced. And he said two things. One was that he was under no pressure to resign. And he said, if I had been under pressure, I wouldn't have done it because that's not proper. And then he said, it was just my diminished strength to continue. That's difficult because every pope, you know, before he dies will be diminished. I mean, that's going to happen. But then he very specifically talked about how he didn't think he could make another international trip. Mm-hmm. And there was World Youth Day scheduled for Rio that summer, and he couldn't do it. So that's why he resigned.
And, of course, you said that some people would say, this is your opinion, mm-hmm. that, you know, these aren't adequate reasons for right. Resignation. Mm-hmm. And you actually proposed some things that he could have done differently, perhaps, to continue in the papacy.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you
Well, I would say that I don't think anybody could say not being able to fly to Brazil is a disqualifying, you know, means you have to resign. I mean, you don't have to go. You could go in some virtual way, or you could go on a ambulance plane. I mean, there's many ways you could get there. So I don't think that was sufficient.
And you cite the example of Sydney, for example, where he went far in advance.
Yeah, he went about 4 or 5 days in advance and went to a retreat house to recover from the trip. So I don't think that that's entirely convincing. What I suggested in the commentary was that, but a period where the Pope wasn't able to do as much is kind of built into the rhythm of the papacy.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
I used the example, actually, of Pope Pius XII, before my time, obviously. But people who were in Rome in the late 50s said they didn't see him that often in public. So the idea of the Pope always being around all the time, if that had to change, I'm not saying that would have been a good thing, but it may have been a good thing. We don't know.
You say something very beginning that is quite interesting, and I think it should be said here because obviously hindsight can be 20/20. I mean, we're looking back at this, and one of the things you say in the very beginning of your piece is that to judge the abdication is not necessarily to judge Pope Francis.
Correct. I say that you can make a judgment on that, and I think we have much more information now after what Benedict himself has said than we did 5 years ago. And we have a time to reflect on it and to see what effect in the life of the church it's had. So it doesn't, judging the wisdom of the abdication does not imply a judgment on whether Pope Francis has been good for the church or not good for the church. But practically speaking, Jeanette, that's one of the things that obviously colors your judgment. You look back and you say, you know, would I prefer Benedict to be pope or not be pope? But, you know, if he had stayed as pope, it's no guarantee he'd still be alive. God may have had a different plan. And I mentioned in the commentary that one of the questions in the spring of 2005 was, would John Paul go to the World Youth Day in Cologne? How would he get there? Would he go in a wheelchair? He'd gone to Toronto, and he was already beginning to use the wheelchair a little bit. Would he just go? Would he go into bed? I remember discussions. Would he go in the stretcher on the plane? Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out that there was a solution to all that. He died, and Benedict went instead. So we don't know what would have happened. It could, I mean, that's why I say you can't really make a judgment on Pope Francis, because maybe if Benedict hadn't resigned, maybe he'd have died 6 months later, and Francis would have been elected anyway. So, you know, those counterfactuals you can't know.
Well, there's a point that you make, too, and I'll quote it, that what is foreseen by canon law was incomprehensible to the Catholic imagination, and it was profoundly unsettling. Mm-hmm. I think unsettling is a very good word here. When we're talking, then, about what followed, the resignation or abdication or renunciation of the papacy, however you want to describe it, that we're
in... I think
he
used the word renunciation, actually, yeah.
We're in a new era, then, of the possibility of future popes resigning, and even Pope Francis has sort of hinted that that might be something for him. Mm-hmm. So would that be part of what you think that one of the legacies of, as we're looking 5 years back, that this is now a genuine possibility for popes?
Certainly it's changed everything in that what was thought to be impossible. And I said it was unsettling in the Catholic imagination, not just Catholics. There are a lot of people who are not Catholic who just thought, well, this just can't happen. You know, it just doesn't happen. But it has changed things. Francis has spoken about it. And Benedict, in that same book I made reference to, also says, well, this might be something we'll get used to. So that remains to be seen. What I worry about is that when, as we see today, when a bishop comes under pressure due to his own fault, due to persecution, due to people from outside, due to people inside, whatever, it's always an option to get, he could just resign and solve the problem that way. We experience that in all different kinds of contexts, different countries. That's an option. I don't think anybody wants to see that at the level of the universal pastor, is that pressure brought from inside, outside, you know, due to negligence, due to courage, whatever, the Pope's in a, if I want to say, pressured situation. I don't think anybody wants to see that, oh, well, one way to solve it is a resignation. And until now, that would have never been the option. And we recall from about the Great Jubilee of 2000 until 2005 when John Paul died, it was a regular thing, you know, will he resign? He's going to resign. He's not going to resign. Should he? Shouldn't he? But in the background of all that was a kind of serenity, which, well, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. If that was repeated, like if you could imagine if there had been a resignation before John Paul, that conversation on the last years of his increasing physical infirmity, it would have been a different kind of conversation. And the default may have been, well, he's being stubborn if he's staying, as opposed to the default being, you know, he's got this cross, he has to bear it, and he'll bear it as long as God chooses.
So we're talking to Father Raymond D'Souza, who is a columnist at the Register, a regular columnist, has been so for 20 years. But he is also a parish priest in Canada, in Wolf Island, and he is also the Roman Catholic chaplain at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. And we're grateful to have Father D'Souza in studio today. We're talking about Benedict's abdication 5 years ago and a column that Father wrote at ncregister.com. And you say one thing that I do want to bring up before we conclude, and that is Cardinal Ratzinger took the view that the Holy Spirit had a most defensive role in the election of popes, and that it is a given that is, a given pope was not necessarily the will of God, but the promises of Christ that meant it would not lead to complete ruin.
Right.
Can you explain what you have in his
that path? Question was put right to him, and he said, does the one who comes out of the conclave as Pope, is that God's will? He was asked that question directly before his own election. And he said no. He said, flat out no. It was not a big question for him. He said, because history gives us examples of people who we can't say the Holy Spirit wanted that for the church. So he said, I think the role of the Holy Spirit in guiding the conclave is that whoever comes out will not, and that those are his words, it won't be a complete ruination. It won't lead to complete ruin. So he said it's a defensive role. And I think what he had in mind was you had men very worldly who were trying to use the papacy for ignoble purposes, but they didn't capsize the whole thing. Maybe a lot of things were sacrificed, but they didn't compromise the faith or whatever. So he had this defensive idea. And I think you could apply that to Benedict's decision. I have no doubt that he's a holy man. Mm-hmm. I have great admiration for him. And I have no doubt that he did not what he wanted only, but what he thought was God's will. That I have no doubt. But you can stipulate all that as being true and say that maybe it wasn't God's will.
Sure.
That he made that that decision, that sort of more defensive role, which is a more modest view of the way the Holy Spirit works. I might add that one of the things that's interesting in recent papal history is the time of John Paul I. And you could say, well, that clearly was God's will to elect the pope that lasted only 33 days. And so the shock of that would provoke something entirely new, a pope who wasn't Italian, and this extraordinary pope at 58 that John Paul II was. Or you could read that and say, well, the cardinals made a mistake. They got the wrong guy, pardon me, the wrong, you know, candidate. And they had to do it over. So you can, you know, we don't know God's will exactly, and you can read it in different ways. And that's an example from not that long ago. We could say the same thing. You know, did the Cardinals in 78 do God's will twice or just the second time? You know, that sort of thing.
And then there's the added interesting aspect of Pope Benedict, typical of Benedict, as we would expect from someone of his stature, but also of his humility, that from the very beginning, he recognized and gave his total obedience to Pope Francis.
Yes, this is, you're referring, Matthew, to a news story that came out that one of his private secretaries, who was present when Pope Francis, freshly elected, maybe 20 minutes or something, called Pope Benedict, who was at Castel Gandolfo, and this private secretary related his end of the conversation. He heard Pope Benedict, then by that time Pope Emeritus, say to Pope Francis, I give you my total obedience. Which, of course, that's a novelty, never been done before, because the Pope was already dead at that stage.
Right.
And so that was a nice personal touch that we only heard now. And I think, actually, maybe, you know, there are people like Cardinal Harvey, who was the prefect out of the papal household for John Paul and Benedict, Archbishop Gansfein, who's serving Francis and Benedict, and maybe in their memoirs, you know, so maybe 30 years from now, we'll have a much more complete account of what happened.
Sure.
And you know what I said 1 year ago, 5 years ago, or what I said yesterday, I might have to revise if I'm still writing for the Register 50 years afterwards.
That would be quite interesting, and we certainly hope so. You have one more thought.
Well, yeah, but relevant to that that call, mm-hmm. was, can we say that Benedict at that point was particularizing his pledge of obedience in the same way that he gave a general pledge of obedience on the last day in his last minutes with the College of Cardinals that sent him off?
Yes, I think Benedict knew this was, well, obviously he knew this was a new thing. And when he spoke to the Cardinals before he says farewell, I think he wanted to let them know, look, they're not going to be two popes. I'm not going to be running a kind of a commentary or undermining or, you know, doing my own thing. And so he said, look, whichever one of you is elected, I promise obedience too. So in a sense, what he said in that private phone call was confirming, you know, I said this a few days ago, or a few weeks ago, I guess it would have been, and now I make that personal. I think you're right about that, Matthew.
Well, of course, now we're in another phase of Pope Benedict's life. As he himself has said, he feels as though he's in his final days, his final journey home, in a letter just this week. So as we conclude this show, I think we remember Pope Benedict in our thoughts and in our prayers during this final journey. Father D'Souza, thanks so much for being with
us
today.
Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you, Matthew. It's good to be here in Irondale at headquarters for
Absolutely.
The first time, so it's great.
Look forward to many more conversations
yes,
to come.
Thank you.
And please take a look at Father D'Souza's column, Benedict XVI's Abdication 5 Years Later, at ncregister.com. When we come back, Matthew and I will talk to Vatican correspondent Edward Penton, again here in studio, about the resignation in these 5 years. This is Register Radio on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio Network.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I am joined here in studio with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. Welcome, Matthew.
It's a great pleasure to be here in person in studio.
Absolutely. And we are also joined by Edward Penton, who joins us from Rome.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
But who is in studio.
Yes, also here.
Very good. It's so good to have you back, Edward. Thanks for nice crossing the great big pond and joining us once again. And, of course, this week we are continuing this conversation about Pope Benedict's abdication or resignation. And you were there in Rome at the time, correct?
I was, yes.
Do you remember how you received the news?
Funny enough, it wasn't through someone in Rome. It was a colleague in Milan who sent me a message by Skype, and he said, "Is this true?" And I instantly rang up Greg Burke, actually, mm-hmm. funny enough, who was then Strategic Communications. And he just said, "It's true, 28th of February," which is when he was going to step down, and then he hung up.
He very, very busy. He probably had a few other things
to do. But it was it was one of those times you never forget.
Absolutely. Yeah. And looking back at that now, at the reasons for Pope Benedict's abdication, I mean, in 5 years later, what are your thoughts on that? We just talked to Father D'Souza. You heard, you know, him talking about his own reaction to those thoughts now.
Yes. I think the word unsettling is the right one. It was unsettling then, and it's still unsettling now, because we've seen what's happened since, and it's been a difficult time. I think most people would agree since his resignation. But it was, in some ways, it was very much in keeping with Benedict's personality, in that he was always one to sort of push the boundaries in ways, mm-hmm. always keeping, trying to keep in continuity with tradition, with orthodoxy, but at the same time pushing the envelope quite a bit. And in a way, it was the sort of the perfect fitting end for his pontificate, in a way, because it was a sort of innovation which was very much in keeping with his really keen willingness to keep in continuity, but at the same time a certain progression and to move with the times. And I think it was very much reflective of him and his pontificate.
Yeah, well, talking about the capacity of Pope Benedict, of Joseph Ratzinger, to anticipate trends and signs of the times, you mm-hmm. have a piece for the Register on what you describe as his farsighted address on current challenges in the Church, and it was mm-hmm. clearly prophetic. And
yes.
Now, Joseph Ratzinger had this innate ability to be prophetic, didn't mm. he?
Yes, he did. And this was a speech given in 1989, to a group of European bishops on head of doctrinal commissions in their countries, in Austria. And it was really interesting, because he he talks about what he calls a litany of objections to the church's teaching. And he says these have come from progressive thinking Catholics. And he actually uses that term. And he lists them as four things. And we've seen these four things over the past 50 years especially. And he lists them as contraception, and agreeing to contraception through the primacy of conscience, appealing to conscience, mm-hmm. Not as a well-formed conscience, but as a sort of self-determinated conscience, an individualistic idea of conscience. And then he talks about homosexuality and the view that the church discriminates against homosexuals and all of that. And then he talks about giving the sacraments to the divorced and remarried. And of course, we've all seen that that's been a very controversial subject for the past 5 years. And then the final thing that these progressive thinking Catholics push is women priests. We haven't seen that yet, but it was, of course, ruled out definitively by John Paul II.
Pope Francis himself has said that this is a door that's closed.
Yes, he has. But at the same time, he has opened this commission on women deacons, which some people think is another way. But he hasn't said that, so we can't say that. And he's, as you say, he has certainly definitively said no to that. But then he goes on to talk about how this is how they will push these ideas and call them paradigm shifts. And of course, that's another thing we've heard recently. And again, the importance of conscience, trying to appeal to conscience to say that, well, if that's what they feel is right, then you can't stop them, and that's what they want. And again, that's seen as problematic because it's not dealing with what we understand conscience to be, which is to be a well-formed conscience in the teachings of the church. And then he closes it by saying what we as Catholics have to do is really teach the world what the faith really is, not what the world really thinks what the church is. And it reminded me of that famous quote by Archbishop Fulton Sheen, who I think he said, the world doesn't reject the church, it rejects what it thinks the church is. And he's saying, well, that's what we really have to do, is really educate the church, the world, into really knowing what the church really teaches.
Well, and you make a point in this piece that Cardinal Ratzinger noted how these objections question both sexual morality and the church's sacramental order, but then you make the point, and quoting him, that they're very much linked together, springing, and this is an idea that was central to a lot of the teachings of Pope Benedict, and certainly Joseph Ratzinger, of a particular notion of human freedom.
Yes.
What it is to be authentically free.
Yes, that's right. And it's he talks about it being obviously a misplaced idea of freedom. And of course, John Paul II was very strong on that it's not freedom to do just as you want. It's all about responsibility and responsibility to the other, as well as your own freedom. So, and then that's the true freedom that you have.
I mean, it's funny to jump from 1989 with this prophetic speech to his homily just before the start of the conclave. In 2005, yes. On the dictatorship of relativism.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes, this is also, it all plays into that, this idea of moral relativism. And he also talks about the problem is that the kingdom of God is has been completely substituted by this utopia of a better world, but it's a yearning that doesn't actually suffice. And he said, actually, it's dangerous if the better world terminology predominates in prayers and sermons and inadvertently replaces the faith with a placebo. So it's very relevant, I think, to today, because there is this sense that perhaps it's too human centered much in the church today.
But also classically, the case with Joseph Ratzinger, he just doesn't end it there, does he? He has a few positive things to say.
Yes, yes, he does. And he says at the end he doesn't want to end on a negative note. And he does say, you know, we have to discern what is in there in modern world, which is actually helping to correct traditions of the past, which we don't need anymore, which we or which could be improved. And so he does say that, but he also says, you know, that there's dangerous problems with this thinking.
And the quote you include is, "Only then can we reveal the faith as the alternative which the world awaits after the failure of the liberalistic and Marxist experiments. This is today's challenge to Christianity. Herein lies our great responsibility as Christians at the present time." It sounds like almost a perfect definition of the new evangelization.
Yes, yes, it does. Yes, and moving on from these tired concepts that we've lived through for the past 100 years.
You know, what strikes me as we think back on Pope Benedict, of course, we're talking about, and you know, a kind of dark moment when he steps down from the papacy. But when we think, when I think back, this is very prophetic, and it is also a bit dark. You know, as he wrote in 1989.
Mm.
But his papacy itself was one that was full of joy. I mean, he really got down to the basics of preaching Jesus Christ, and he did so with a lot of joy. I think back, because we're having a very serious conversation about a place that we find ourselves where there's a lot of division and a lot of worldliness that is even within the church. But Pope Benedict himself, while he will be remembered, as Father D'Souza said in his piece, by this resignation, probably the biggest lens by which he'll be remembered, yet so much of what he wrote and showed to the world was the beauty of Catholicism and of the Church. So it's, I hate to think of him being defined by this, by the abdication. You know, it's just my own thoughts on it, but...
Yes, yes. No, it's true. And his legacy of writings and in his books and his teaching, I mean, it was just the greatest. I mean, it was, I think most people agree, it was such a strong teaching pontificate with real substance there that people learned so much about.
And clear. I mean, Pope John Paul was a teaching pope too, in a way.
Yes.
He taught a lot by his visible example of things in how charismatic his gestures, exactly. But he wasn't the easiest person to read. He wasn't the easiest writer, you know. I found Pope Benedict so clear. And for me, it was very easy to be catechized by Pope Benedict. And I miss that. I do miss that. Now, of course, we're thinking about Pope Benedict for another reason these last few weeks, not simply because of this 5-year anniversary of his resignation, but because he recently wrote a letter. We spoke a little bit in the first section, a letter he wrote to an Italian newspaper, just talking about these being his last days. He's 90 years old, I believe, 91 in May?
In April.
April 16th.
Yes. Yes, one of the senior editors of Corriere della Sera, a major Italian newspaper, wrote to him a few weeks ago saying, our many readers want to know how you're doing and coming up to this 5th anniversary. And so he just wrote a very short note to say, he was very grateful for their thoughts and prayers, and that he's sort of in his final phase of life. But he said he's surrounded by immense joy and immense and the love of people. But I think, yeah, he was. It's been a very difficult time, I expect, for him. I mean, I don't know, but he has been surrounded by many. He's seen lots of people come and visit him, but lately he's cut back on them because he is becoming so frail. He thinks very sharply, but he has trouble moving around.
He's in a wheelchair.
I don't know if he's in a wheelchair, but he needs a walker.
Okay,
to get around. But yes, he's his mind is still very much alert.
And talking about the joy and our gratitude to him for a life of service, these last 5 years he has spent in prayer, in contemplation. In praying for us, and are we able to derive the kind of comfort that we can from knowing that the Pope Emeritus is there, this kind of spiritual powerhouse, hidden away in the Vatican Gardens, but still praying for us?
Yes, yes. And I think he realizes that's a strong thing for the faithful, to know that he is there praying for us. Yes, it's very much his, I think he wanted to do that, which is why he took the name Pope Emeritus. He wanted to continue to be not obviously Pope, but to be a person of obviously quite still of certain authority, but in the terms of being contemplative, and that's what
certainly
he did.
I think there's a great solidarity in that with the rest of us of Catholics all over the world. Even though we don't see him, we don't hear from him, we know that he is there and he is still playing a very important role in the book in the church. We're talking to Edward Penton, our correspondent in Rome, who covers the Vatican for us. He's actually here in Birmingham at EWTN, and we've been most grateful for this conversation. Thanks for being here.
Okay, thanks for being with me, Beth.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless.